Hello, and welcome to The P-Value, a podcast about science, philosophy, and everything in between. The P-Value is an initiative of the Centre for Philosophy of the Sciences at the Australian National University. In 2010, scientists found some bacteria in remote Lake Mono in Yosemite National Park in California, which threatened to redefine life as we know it. The Lake Mono bacteria appeared to be able to substitute arsenic for phosphorus in their DNA and proteins, overturning the long-held view that just six biological elements – carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen,
phosphorus,
oxygen and sulfur – are necessary for life. Unfortunately, later the discovery was shown to be an error. No arsenic substitution was actually taking place. Nonetheless, the discovery revived debates about the nature of life and our ability to recognise new or novel ways of living that we might come across. What was it about arsenic bacteria that would have warranted extending our account of life? Would we have been so happy to make such a move had arsenic life looked less familiar to us? The question of what life is might seem obvious. We seem pretty good at discerning when we're looking at a living or non-living thing. Rock, non-living. Fish, living. Plant, living. Dirt, non-living, etc. But this sort of folk knowledge doesn't work well when we look at the more strange parts of our world. Viruses, for example, might seem to be living, but they aren't capable of reproducing for themselves. They have no capacity for respiration or metabolism, or anything else really, except inside the cell of another living organism. They are essentially little protein capsules containing RNA and DNA and very little else, which has led some to say they're not living at all. We lack a clear definition of life, a definition which makes clear what it is about all the apparently living things, the bacteria, fungi, birds, penguins, whales, and humans, which distinguishes them from other non-living things, and what any new entity we come across must have in order to be classed as life or living. This week in The P-Value, we talk about life, what it is, and whether we would be able to recognise alien life if we saw it. US space agency NASA defines life as any self-sustaining chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution. This, they argue, captures all the cases of life we know of, and thus is a good working definition of life, which can be updated should new evidence about life, such as finding alien life, arise. While this sort of definition might seem reasonable, we could worry that it's too parochial, too heavily indexed to our own planet and life here. Philosopher of biology Emily Park from the University of Auckland expresses this worry well. She says, "It cannot be assumed that life elsewhere would resemble life as we know it, in even the most basic ways. So we need some way to recognise it that abstracts away from life as we know it. Is such a thing possible? How do we define life in such a way that it leaves open the possibility that there are very different living things elsewhere we just haven't found yet?" Definitional skeptics argue that we are asking too much to expect a definition of life that's universal. Carol Cleland and Christopher Chiba are definitional skeptics. They argue that we aren't in an epistemic position to define life as we only have a single sample, life on Earth, from which to derive any general principles. They say, "No purported definition of life can provide a scientifically satisfying answer to the question, what is life? Because no mere analysis using human concepts can reveal the nature of the world that lies beyond them." Cleland and Chiba are pointing here to the limited inductive base we have to work with when it comes to any definition of life. Life on Earth, you see, is widely accepted to have arisen from just one source, one origination. This, they argue, gives us insufficient grounds for making claims about life in general. Any concept of life we have can only reflect life on Earth, and thus the peculiarities of life here, not life more broadly. Moreover, says Cleland, trying to define life from such a limited base risks hindering or obscuring our ability to find life on other planets, because it may mean that we overlook life that's too different to that on Earth. What do we do then? If this sort of definitional pessimism is true, then perhaps the best we can do is just construct and empirically test scientific theories about the general nature of living systems. And we can try and use those to settle tricky cases like the virus case. Edouard Machery is also a definitional skeptic, but for slightly different reasons. He argues that attempts to find a definition of life are either pointless or impossible and should be abandoned altogether. He makes his case in two parts, arguing firstly that any definition based on folk concept is unscientific off the bat. Any project based on these sorts of folk definitions of life is, he says, pointless, as it's unable to yield useful predictions and explanations. Definitions of life based in science might seem a better place to go, but he also dismisses them, on the grounds that there's no unified scientific consensus on the matter, and moreover, he says, such a consensus is unlikely. This is because the concept of life and attempts to define it are spread across many scientific disciplines, from astrobiology to evolutionary biology, artificial life, synthetic biology, even ethics. These different sciences have very different research agendas around life, and their definitions reflect this. An evolutionary definition of life, for example, like the NASA one, is appealing to synthetic biologists as they can observe whether the artificial life that they build can evolve. Astrobiologists, on the other hand, would not find such definitions as satisfactory, because frequently they're looking for life in situations that preclude observations of evolution. For example, when looking at dead or fossilized structures in meteorites. We are now, says Machery, likely to end up with several definitions of life, which naturally raises the following questions. Which of these definitions would tell us what life is? For these reasons, Machery thinks the project of defining life is either impossible or pointless, and we should just discard it. Indeed, he goes on to say that the whole idea we need a definition to proceed with the science of life is mistaken anyway. Research into the nature of life, its origins and diversity, can and has continued without a definition just fine. So we should stop wringing our hands and return to the bench. Whilst the definitional skeptics appear to have a point, not everyone agrees. We'll look at three such views after the break. Leonardo Fish, Sarah Green and others, including Emily Park, concede that the skeptics might be right about the prospects of actually getting an agreed-upon definition of life. But they conclude more optimistically. They say that definitions of life can play a useful role in science even if there's no consensus possible. Weaker, localized, operational definitions, they point out, can be used to help narrow down our research agenda and interests. For example, they can help us decide which biomarkers to test for in samples from Mars. They can help guide our search and resources to the sorts of places most likely to harbour life. Such working or operational definitions need not be universal. Different disciplines can adopt what suits their purposes. And such definitions are typically understood to be revisable given new evidence. The NASA definition falls under this sort of category. NASA sees this as a guide, but not a definitive or irrefutable one to life. This sort of response, of course, will not convince the skeptic, like Cleland, who sees the NASA concept as hindering our ability to discover, to use her words, life as we don't know it. For Cleland, a working definition, if based on biology on Earth, risks us stumbling over life very different to our own and missing it entirely. Kelly Smith offers a more fatalistic sort of optimism in arguing that there's simply no viable alternative to the pursuit of definitions of life, at least given our current epistemic and theoretical situation. And thus, he says, it's the best we can do. To quote him, the bottom line is that there is simply no viable alternative, either pragmatically or theoretically, to the pursuit of definitions. If nothing else, the empirical data that pessimists demand will be a very long time coming, and scientists will, of necessity, continue to employ definitions of life in the interim. Chastising them for this will only drive their ideas underground, where they can escape critical analysis, making the problems caused by problematic conceptions of life worse. Therefore, however messy and confused things might be, science really has no choice but to follow Churchill's advice and just keep plodding on. In fact, we would be well advised to produce more definitions of life and wholeheartedly embrace the debate that ensues. Smith and Park also point out that we may be being too narrow with how we look at the definitional project in the first place. Definitions, they say, can take many forms, not just a single set of necessary and sufficient conditions. And hence failure to achieve such a definition of life is no reason to give up on the project of defining life altogether. Biological systems are, after all, typically messy. Attempts to define all sorts of biological phenomena, from species to human nature, disease, the gene, even biological individuality, have all resisted simple categorizations defined by necessary and sufficient conditions. Why, then, think life will be any different? If this is the case, perhaps we need to think of life dimensionally, or as having vague boundaries, rather than being all or nothing. Such reconceptualizations of life would be radical. But perhaps, as Cleland points out, radical is what's needed to fully capture the true richness of the potential living things in the universe. You've been listening to The P-Value. I'm your host, Dr. Rachel Brown. See you next time.